Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. This Sunday marks the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. With the stroke of his pen, President George H.W. Bush changed the lives of millions of people living with disabilities. The ADA is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination against individuals with disabilities in all areas of public life, including jobs, schools, transportation, and all public and private places that are open to the general public. The purpose of the law is to make sure that people with disabilities have the same rights and opportunities as everyone else. Pennsylvania played a major role in the history of the ADA, and probably no place more so than the Pennhurst State School and Hospital in Spring City, Chester County. In 80 years, more than 10,000 people with disabilities lived at Pennhurst. During most of that time, anyone with a disability could be, and often would be, put in an institution like Pennhurst, a place where residents were referred to as inmates. A new book is out on Pennhurst. It's called Pennhurst and the Struggle for Disability Rights. Joining us, the editors of that book, author and professor emeritus of history at Millersville University, Dr. Dennis Downey. Dr. Downey, always good to talk to you.
Good morning, Scott.
Co-editor and author, Dr. James Conroy, a social science researcher and co-president of the Pennhurst Memorial Alliance. Dr. Conroy, glad to have you on the program this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for having us.
And Debbie Robinson, a self-advocate and the executive director of Speaking for Ourselves. Ms. Robinson, I'm glad to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dennis Downey, let me start with you. How did Pennhurst contribute to what eventually became the Americans with Disability Act?
Well, Scott, Pennhurst was a state institution, opened in 1908. It closed in 1987, and it personified the trend towards institutionalization for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, what then was called people who were feeble-minded. And over nearly a century's time, eight decades, there was a movement from exclusion and isolation to inclusion and community involvement. In the post-World War II era, given the controversies, medical experimentation, abuse, and outright violence that occurred at Pennhurst and most other institutions, there was a backlash by advocacy groups, parent groups, and eventually attorneys in court, which challenged the right of people to have full constitutional protections. And that led to the process of deinstitutionalization and the closing of places like Pennhurst. So Pennhurst foreshadowed a national trend and really was a driving force in that trend that brought people from institutionalization back into community living arrangements.
We're going to talk about the history of Pennhurst and a lot of the topics that you just touched on, Dennis, in just a few minutes. Dr. Conroy, under the ACA, what rights do those living with a disability, an intellectual disability or developmental disability in particular, what rights do they have because of the American with Disabilities Act?
It's very simple. They have the full rights of American citizenship, which had been denied in so many ways for so long. And it's that simple. It's the civil rights, the human rights of people, regardless of disability, just as in the other civil rights laws, without regard to race, religion, or creed, country of origin, we now stood shoulder to shoulder with the other great movements.
You know, one of the things that I found most interesting, and I doubt that many people, especially outside those who are familiar with those living with disabilities, realize, is that the 1954 U.S. Supreme Court ruling Brown versus Board of Education, which many people point to as obviously a turning point in the civil rights movement for African Americans in this country, that Brown versus Board of Education had an influence on civil rights for those living with a disability, correct?
Indeed. Correct. And I would credit Tom Gilhool, the attorney, with making that explicit connection in court and the notion of not only due process but equal protection under the law. That was the basis for Brown. It was also the basis for the subsequent Park case, Haldeman versus Pennhurst, and even Romeo versus Youngberg, all of which came out of Pennhurst and pushed forward the idea of equal protection under the law for all citizens, as Jim had said.
Now, you mentioned Tom Gilhool, and I just want to make sure that our audience knows the players in the story here. Who was Tom Gilhool? You mentioned he was an attorney.
Well, Tom Gilhool, who at one point was Secretary of Education in the Casey administration, is a civil rights and disability rights attorney in Philadelphia, who worked with David Furlinger and eventually came into onto the scene as the chief litigator for the Pennsylvania ARC. And he challenged in court the right to education, and from that came Pennhurst and the right to services and protections. And so Tom articulated the strategy, which eventually proved to be successful in challenging so much of what was going on within institutional walls.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, Jim, do you want to add?
Well, I think it may be of interest to a wide audience to know that the people who wound up at Pennhurst usually went there as adolescents because they weren't allowed in public school. So the first solution that Tom Gilhool, the great attorney, urged the ARC to follow was get the right for everybody to go to public school, and that changed the world.
And I think that anyone can make that connection then between Brown versus Board of Education. Debbie Robinson, you were present when President Bush signed the American with Disabilities Act 30 years ago on Sunday. Because you had been working for so long with those living with a disability. Do you remember what you were feeling that day as the president signed that that bill? Do you remember what you were feeling?
Well, I was feeling proud. First of all, that was speaking for itself, that we was invited. I didn't know anybody. I was still the new kid on the block. I really came from New York and didn't even know anything about institutions until I really came out here to Philadelphia. Mark and Roland, who started speaking for himself, Mark drove us to D.C. with me, Roland, another member of mine, Steve Dorsey. And that's where I met Justin Dartz, who led the fight for the ADA. So I was still learning. And just being part of Speaking for Itself, an organization that was very powerful around then, because we were one of the organizations that, you know, most of our members in Speaking for Itself came from Pennhurst. Mm-hmm. So I was still new at the time and learning, but it was an exciting event and something I have never experienced in my lifetime.
So in the 30 years since President Bush signed that legislation, when you were there, has it worked out like you thought it would 30 years ago? I mean, has the ADA worked like you thought it would 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of things. The states, the first you know, people had to learn about the ADA and what our law and rights were. So, you know, getting the states on board, making a lot of changes, understanding the law. We had a lot of education to do. And, you know, some of the states was not on board. So we had still a lot of advocates, including our Speaking for Itself, had to, you know, still had to fight because in the beginning people didn't take, some of the states didn't take it as well. So we really had other people on our side, Bill West from, you know, in Pennsylvania. So we still had a lot of work to be done in education to understand the ADA and our rights.
But when you say that some states didn't take it as well, I mean, a lot of
when the ADA was, you know, people had to get used to it, had to follow it. We had to understand what the law was and, you know, some others, you know, and then the advocates had to really, we really had to educate ourselves. We had to get our members and advocates and other groups and other states on board on how this is going to work and our rights. People with disabilities didn't even have rights to speak up or say what they wanted for breakfast, for lunch, or anything. They didn't even know what their rights was. Mm-hmm. So you know, it took a little while for everybody to be on board, feel comfortable, and make the changes for us to go out and in the community and do things, because things wasn't accessible. We couldn't go out and do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go back now, because in your book, it's broken down into three parts, but history is a major part of it. And I know that Dennis in particular, that when we hear with today's sensibilities, the language we use, that kind of thing, and we hear some of these things, just even the language, it is appalling. I mean, Pennhurst was called the Eastern State Institution for the Feeble-Minded and Epileptics. Take us back to 1908. I mean, in 1908, there were medical professionals, some of the best minds, at least in the Philadelphia area, that were saying, this is how you take care of, or I don't even know whether take care of is the best way to put it, this is what you do with people with intellectual disabilities. Take us back to 1908 when Pennhurst was constructed and opened.
Surely. Well, Pennhurst, which was a state facility authorized by the General Assembly in 1903, opened in 1908 in Chester County. And in every respect, it was not only a product of modern medicine and social reform, conservative social reform, it was a product of eugenics. Eugenics was a scientific and social theory that promoted what was called good breeding. You want to breed in the fit and breed out the unfit. And reaching back into the late 19th century, a very unflattering set of terms emerged to describe people who had some kind of physical or mental disability. Pennhurst was for children and adults who had a cognitive or mental disability. People who were called feeble-minded, imbeciles, morons, and the like. They were degenerates. They were misfits. They were seen as a threat to society. And they were also a burden to their family. And in Pennsylvania and across the country, really across the world, eugenics took hold at the turn of the 20th century. And Pennhurst was opened, like Polk in western Pennsylvania and institutions throughout the country, to literally segregate, to separate out this element of the population in the hopes that if we could keep them from reproducing. This is managed human reproduction that this class of citizens, as Thurgood Marshall described them, would eventually weed away. The agenda was not extermination. That came later in Nazi Germany. This was elimination by controlling human breeding. So through institutionalization, through sexual sterilization, through laws that prohibited not only sexual relations, but prohibited marriage, the hope of these eugenics reformers was that a population of citizens who were inconvenient and unwanted would simply disappear over time. And Pennhurst, which was thought to be a model institution, ended up being a nightmare for so many of the residents as a result of this underlying ideology that persisted well into the 20th century.
You know, Dennis, what you just described, and these were supposedly the brightest medical minds in the world making these decisions, saying that an intellectual developmental disability, but intellectual disability in particular, was genetics, that it came from parents. And as you described, that the people who were living with a disability, an intellectual disability, had to be stopped from reproducing. They had to stop it in their tracks. You quote one doctor in the book as saying that this was the biggest problem facing the country, was, you know, that there were people living with disabilities. I mean,
yes.
This is only a little over 100 years ago. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
And you're referring to one of the best medical minds in America, Charles Frazier, who said the single great problem that confronts us is the problem of the feeble-minded. And what concerned him was the so-called rising tide of feeble-mindedness, and particularly the wayward behavior of young girls reaching puberty who had an inability to control their passions, and they would breed others like them. So like begets like. And for Charles Frazier and many other of the most eminent scientists and social theorists of the early 20th century, this was emerging as the great social problem that reformers had to confront. And institutions became one solution to solving that problem.
Mm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. And before we go any further in a conversation, we'll mention that you should... You really should, if you haven't seen it already, you should take a look at I Go Home. It chronicles the role institutionalization played in the life of people with intellectual disabilities in 1960s America and shines a light on the struggles and triumphs of the disability rights movement. This is a WITF original production, I Go Home. It will be broadcast this Sunday at noon on WITF-TV. And I have to tell you, that's one of the best productions that WITF has ever made. And I think that you can just learn so much about Pennhurst and intellectual disabilities and fighting for rights for those living with intellectual disabilities. I Go Home Sunday at noon on WITF. Our guest during this portion of the program, author and professor emeritus of history at Millersville University, Dr. Dennis Downey, co-editor of the new book, Pennhurst and the Struggle for Disability Rights. Both Dr. Downey and Dr. James Conroy, who is a social science researcher and co-president of the Pennhurst Memorial Alliance, and Debbie Robinson is a self-advocate and the executive director of Speaking for Ourselves, and we'll be talking more about Speaking for Ourselves in just a few minutes. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. There's a lot of history to cover here, and Dennis Downey, I wanted to talk a lot about that history to begin the program, and then we can get into more of the civil rights movement, if you will, for those living with a disability, and then Pennhurst today, and you know, what's going on today with people who are living with disabilities and the challenges that they face, and how the ADA has adapted to that. So let's go back a little bit more with history. You know, one of the things I think you touched on this just a few minutes ago. But there was experimentation that went on amongst the residents of Pennhurst, especially before World War One and then World War Two. I mean, the residents at Pennhurst were referred to as inmates at one time. I mean, this was a place that was designed for 500 people, but at one time had over 3,000 people living there. So it was overcrowded. Maybe you can describe, Dennis, what it was like. I mean, what, and Dr. Conroy, I'm going to talk to you once you saw it for the first time. But what was it like in those early years, maybe up through the 30s and 40s? What did it look like? What were the residents actually doing?
Well, I'll just add that Pennhurst sat on Crab Hill in northern Chester County, just outside of Spring City. So about 24 miles from downtown Philadelphia. It was originally opened for a population of 500 people with the expectation that both women and men, boys and girls, would eventually be living there. And over time, there were, well, really almost from the very beginning, there were complaints about understaffing, overcrowding, and a lack of adequate resources to meet the needs of the center. And those complaints grew as Pennhurst itself grew. And by the 1950s and 1960s, because of overcrowding, because of inadequate staffing, and because of just the day-to-day insults of institutionalization, Pennhurst became a very different and it became a much more dangerous place to live for many, many of the residents. And Bill Baldini's 1968 documentary, Suffer the Little Children, brought this to light in glaring detail. And Jim, who himself visited Pennhurst in that era, can speak to that. But in the early days, at least the notion was this would be a model institution. And it really did end up becoming like a nightmare. And the descriptions of people, of what people saw and experienced, what they smelled when they entered Pennhurst, were really quite alarming. Regarding medical experimentation, anybody at Pennhurst was a ward of the state. And particularly in the aftermath of the great influenza outbreak in 1918, the so-called Spanish influenza, there was enormous pressure upon medical researchers and scientists to come up with vaccines. And by the late 1930s, with the approach of World War II, the federal government got heavily involved in funding research for vaccines for influenza, cholera, smallpox, dysentery, eventually mumps and measles, and of course by the 1950s, the great polio trials out at Polk in western Pennsylvania. So you had a ready population that was there without their consent, and you have institutional officials working in league not only with the government but with medical researchers to do medical testing. And this was a common practice at Pennhurst, Polk, Hamburg, Willowbrook in New York, all the way west to Sonoma in California. And Jonas Salk is a fine example of someone. He went to Polk to test his polio vaccine. And where else to find a ready population? And the decision that was made early on was you did not need the consent of the person being tested to inject them with a live virus, a food supplement, or anything else. So the appalling trend that emerged, one might say out of medical necessity, really undermined what confidence families could have in the institution.
Were families,
once this all came to light.
Were families aware that this experimentation was going on?
I don't think they were aware until really the early 1970s when people like Ginny Thornburg and Ginny and Dick Thornburg wrote the introduction to the book, the foreword to the book. But Ginny Thornburg and Pat Clapp and Eleanor Elkin and other mothers and families and eventually the ARC began to investigate. And they saw this was not only a trend at Pennsylvania institutions, it was a national trend that had to be stopped. And by 1973, given the controversies, Pennsylvania declares a moratorium on testing at institutions.
Now, there were, you mentioned how appalling the situation was at Pennhurst. When, you know, some of the things that you found, Dr. Conroy, I'm going to talk to you about your first impressions in just a few minutes, but I mean, the people who were living at Pennhurst were divided into different categories. Dennis, talk about that if you would. I mean, there were some who could be trained, who were worked, and then there were others who didn't. Talk about that, how they were divided.
Well, in the enabling legislation in 1903, they followed the common practice of separating residents between an industrial and a custodial population. And those who could work and engage in labor that benefited the institution were put to work. It could be in the fields, it could be on the dairy farm, it could be in the wood shop, it could be in the laundry. And their labor, which was uncompensated labor, it was peonage, according to the Supreme Court, their labor helped to maintain a profit margin at Pennhurst over the decades. Eventually, those residents also came to provide personal care, hygienic care, showering, toileting, and whatnot for other patients who were thought to be less capable of caring for themselves. In the balance over time, the custodial population grew significantly, meaning people who needed attention and needed 24/7 assistance, and the industrial or the educable population either maintained a status quo or declined. So there's a real shift. And by the 1960s, and I'll defer to Jim on this. By the 1960s, what happened was you had about 50 to 70 residents per staff member in a day room, and people who walked around unattended, uncared for, undressed, and really their most basic needs were not met. Children were left in cribs all day long, so their muscles atrophied, and they didn't get the kind of attention that they needed.
And there was, I mean, just what you described is exploitation, but there was a lot of abuse, including sexual abuse, that was going on as well, correct?
Well, whether we say there's a lot or not, there was a commonplace pattern of violence and both physical and oftentimes sexual abuse. And state police investigations, and Cliff Shaw was one of the chief investigators, documented how both staff and inmates could turn on other inmates for sport, for punishment, and for sexual pleasure. And I think that if anybody that reads Roland Johnson's autobiography, Lost in the Desert World, gets a really startling sense of just how dark it could be, especially in the nighttime hours.
Mm. Dr. Downey just described, he mentioned Bill Baldini. Bill Baldini was a young reporter for WCAU-TV in Philadelphia, did a five-part series called Suffer the Little Children, that he went to Pennhurst and just was, along with everyone else who has ever seen it, appalled at the conditions that the residents were living in. Dr. Conroy, you came a little bit later. Talk about how you got to Pennhurst and your first impressions of what you saw.
Very well. Bill Baldini saw the conditions at Pennhurst in 1968 and revealed them to the world, the first time people in their living rooms could see reality of what was going on at Pennhurst. Beds 6 inches apart, 50 people sleeping in one room, and nobody in control of what happened at night. A few years later, in 1971, I was just out of college. I got a job working on a study of developmental disabilities, a brand new term. I drew a random sample of facilities to visit to deepen our understanding for the project, and the first place I went was Philadelphia. And one of the places I went was Pennhurst. So what Dr. Downey describes is, it actually can't be described. Walking into a unit, a living unit, where half the people are naked, everyone is screaming, people are rocking, self-stimulating, and there are two staff in a glass enclosure in the corner of the room, and they are able to do nothing. Two staff with 50 people in various degrees of disorientation and self-abuse and mutual abuse. There was nothing the workers could do. We can't even blame the workers for the conditions, but I had never seen anything like that. I got a good education in America and went to the best schools, and I walked into hell and couldn't believe it was happening in America.
So what did you do from there?
Well, I decided we had to improve, and I devoted my life to it. America can do better than that. I wound up spending my life in the research end of things, where Pennhurst turned out to be the place on Earth where humanity learned there's a better way. Because when the people left Pennhurst, we did solid science for 20 years here and several other states, and we finally found out once and for all, firmly, scientifically, and conclusively, that people are better off when they live in small community homes among the rest of us. Way better off. Better off in every way we know how to measure, better off. So that was a dramatic finding, and it's had world consequences, and it really began at Pennhurst. That's where America and the world learned there's a better way.
The research showed, when you said that people were better off living by themselves or in a group home or, you know, outside of an institution, that you actually, I don't know if it was you, but the research showed that you know, measured some of the residents at Pennhurst, and you know, there were some measurements there that they actually did worse. They regressed from living in an institution, correct?
That is true. Part of the evidence in the court case was presented, and very strong evidence, that a person would go into Pennhurst with certain self-care skills and ability to speak and so forth, and they would lose them while at Pennhurst, which made much more astounding that these same people, when they came out into small, family-like settings in regular neighborhoods, they still had the capacity to grow and learn and develop. It's you can't keep the human spirit down.
So talk about some of those court cases. As you mentioned, this was 1971 when you started and went to Pennhurst and other institutions. Some of the court cases, there were parental advocacy groups that started speaking up. But the group that Debbie Robinson is executive director of right now is one that you were one of the founders of Speaking for Ourselves. Talk about how that came to be.
Are you asking me?
No, Dr. Conroy, I'll start with you and then go to Debbie.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was a proud witness to the beginning of Speaking for Ourselves. People who came out of Pennhurst were facilitated, helped, assisted, and supported by a great man named Mark Friedman to get together and talk about their experience in living in the community and trying to cope with the trauma and PTSD that so many experienced from living at Pennhurst. So Speaking for Ourselves began in the early 80s, and it's my favorite chapter in our book is the story of how it started. So over to you, Debbie. You were there from the beginning.
Yeah, Debbie,
well,
how did it start?
I came and went in 87, and Mark and Roland took me. I had, like I said, I didn't know anything about it. I came in 87, in the 80s, late 80s, and they took me to my first experience going around to an institution was Pennhurst, and that was the day they was closing, getting ready to close. Roland was in the back seat. I was in the front. Mark was driving. They was telling me about institutions because I had no idea whatsoever because I came from New York. You know, even though we have a famous institution, I found out later on in New York I didn't know anything about. So I got the education about institutions at Pennhurst through Roland, was my teacher. He was my mentor.
That's Roland Johnson.
What I am today.
Yes, Roland Johnson,
so,
yeah.
Yes. He came from Pennhurst. He told Mark to take me to Pennhurst. They took me the day that that they were getting ready to close. We drove around the whole complex, was around the time they were getting ready to close.
What were your impressions? They described to you conditions at Pennhurst, Roland Johnson in particular? What were your impressions of what you were hearing, and then what you saw as it was closing?
It was like in a movie that you see a horror flick. It was very eerie, very scary. I really couldn't think of how you could do stuff like that, and I had the opportunity to hear about Roland's story because I was part of his life. He grew up, told me about what happened and things like that. So getting the story from, from Roland was an eye opener. And also we had a lot of our members in Philadelphia. My first presidency and taking over, being president of a Philadelphia chapter, I had to experience of a whole lot of our members from Philadelphia was in a different institution. We had a lot of our members from Pennhurst also. And they were sharing their stories, but my first experience was in a different institution, and it was just as bad as Pennhurst. Our members of Speaking for Ourselves came from different institutions, and Pennhurst included. So that really led, our members to take on this fight of closing and getting people out and living the life that they wanted to live independently. And Roland led the fight in that here in Pennsylvania, around the country, started a national movement, closed the door because of people living in institutions. And he led the way for all of us to continue to fight to close and get people out and them to live in the community or wherever they wanted to live.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up tomorrow at 9 on WITF, there will be no Smart Talk tomorrow. The Refuge continues with Part 3 on WITF. We will meet an indigenous group that has lived and hunted in the refuge long before it was carved out as protected federal land. We'll hear about what's at stake for them as development looms further north. The Refuge continues tomorrow at 9 on WITF 89.5 and 93.3 and at WITF.org. We have a few minutes left in today's program where we're talking about the 30th anniversary of the American with Disabilities Act and the part that the Pennhurst State Hospital and School played in, as you probably can tell, played a large role once the public saw and understood what was going on behind closed doors at places like Pennhurst, played a large role in the development of the ADA. Our guest today, author and professor emeritus of history at Millersville University, Dr. Dennis Downey, Dr. James Conroy, a social science researcher and co-president of the Pennhurst Memorial Alliance, and Debbie Robinson, a self-advocate and the executive director of Speaking for Ourselves. Again, we have a few minutes left. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. In the few minutes we have left, Dennis, I do want to talk about Pennhurst today, the grounds, and what's going on now. But I think one of the most important parts of this whole story is when the public finally realized what was going on behind closed doors at Pennhurst. Court cases started, advocacy started, and as we've mentioned several times, it finally was closed down in 1987. If you could briefly describe the court cases and how the closing of Pennhurst and the move toward deinstitutionalization started in the 1960s. How did those things occur?
Well, I think that there are a number of attorneys, just to note. One is David Furliger. Another is Judy Grand, and of course a third is, and there are a number of others, Tom Gilhool. And the Public Interest Law Center played a crucial role in a number of the cases. In 1972, the PARC, or Park case, was decided that dealt with the right to a free public education. And that, as Jim said earlier, that really was one of the critical turning points, that children with an intellectual disability did not go to public schools, and this affirmed their right to a free and appropriate education. Several years later, you have the case of Haldeman versus Pennhurst, and Terry Lynn Haldeman, and it was really a class action suit brought by both parents and residents themselves, expanded the argument that Tom Gilhool had put forward in PARC. And then in 1982, Romeo versus Youngberg. So you have three cases over 10 years, all of which rewrite federal constitutional law in terms of extending protections of citizenship to people who were institutionalized and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, so that they had the right to education, the right to social services, the right to, they have the right to dissent from involuntary commitment, I guess you could put it that way, and ultimately the right to live or return and live in the community. These are groundbreaking constitutional cases that fundamentally changed American jurisprudence, and they reshaped federal civil rights law, and they all sort of set up what the ADA would establish through legislation in 1990. And there have been subsequent decisions, Olmstead and others, all of which have not redefined, but they've brought back a clarity to what it means to be a citizen, to have equal protection under the law. And now it's, you know, it's expanded to the area of folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, where before they had been marginalized, segregated, and pushed out of the mainstream. These court cases brought them back into the constitutional mainstream. And it's interesting that Haldeman versus Pennhurst was used by Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, in deciding the Affordable Care Act a few years ago. So they established precedents that still resonate today and lay a foundation for further litigation.
Dr. Conroy, Pennhurst today, it is still there. When I say Pennhurst is still there, many of the buildings, the grounds, what is it today?
Today, the grounds of Pennhurst, the main campus with 22 buildings and about 100 acres, was purchased by a private entity in 2008. And of course, the economy crashed in 2008. And the only way the owners could figure out to make any money to pay taxes and so forth was to open a Halloween attraction. And from the beginning, there was outrage, of course, in the disability community because the actors and the exhibits and the fear was based on people with disabilities as objects of terror. And that was so intolerable. We've worked for more than 10 years now to change that, and I'm really happy to say it has changed at last. The Halloween attraction is in some big old scary buildings, and there are monsters and Halloween creatures, and they get nearly 50,000 people a year. Of course, the virus will change that a bit, but we are now able to partner with them. There's a Pennhurst Museum arising on the grounds in the Mayflower Building, and I'd say things are looking up.
When you say that things have changed, though, wasn't there originally an agreement that the Halloween attraction would not use props or take advantage of those with intellectual disabilities, and the owner did not adhere to that?
Oh, boy, is that true. I was at the meeting with the original owners who said, oh, we won't use any imagery, no insulting disability context, no wheelchairs, straitjackets, so forth and so on. And the next day, we found an ad on Facebook for actors to take part in the Halloween attraction, and the ad said, would you like to play a scary psycho?
And could I just add that Pennhurst was never a psychiatric hospital?
Right. I was going to say that. It was never a mental hospital.
Right.
That's right. And so the misrepresentation, which borders on atrocity, started from the very beginning, and Jim really has led the campaign to get the venue to act in a more responsible and appropriate manner.
I must say, the current general manager of the facility has two daughters with disability, and he says the time of insult is over.
Oh, that's good.
We're happy to hear it.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. So I will ask Jim Conroy one final question. Why is it important that we remember Pennhurst?
It is the place of learning, unlike any other, where we learn that people would do better with better lives and exercise their rights in small family-like homes. And people don't know about the people from Pennhurst. 1,156 people came out. How many wound up homeless or in jail? Zero. Almost no one knows that. What is possible is magnificent, and we have been doing it. I'm proud of America.
Jim Conroy, a social science researcher and co-president of the Pennhurst Memorial Alliance, Professor Emeritus of History at Millersville University, Dr. Dennis Downey, and Debbie Robinson, a self-advocate and executive director of Speaking for Ourselves. The book is Pennhurst and the Struggle for Disability Rights. And I also want to remind you about I Go Home, looking at Pennhurst and that struggle, Sunday at noon on WITF-TV. Thank all three of you for being with us today and the work that you've done. Thank you very much.
Good day.
Thank you, Scott.
So there will not be a Smart Talk tomorrow. I'm on vacation next week. I'll be talking to you a week from Monday, so be sure to tune in every day at 9 o'clock.